something this morning that I actually learned from my oldest boy, Titus. Not precisely learned it from him, but I learned it from dealing with him. Because as a father, I've gone through a lot of things that I had never experienced before. And although I've now got four of these little guys, the oldest one is the one with whom I've gone through them each the first time. And every time that happens and we sort of open a new chapter and we discover a new thing, that makes a big impression on me. And frequently it helps me to understand God better as I pay attention to my relationship with my sons and the behaviors that my sons exhibit, the behaviors that I exhibit, even naturally. And I think this works so well because we are a very good analogy for God and His children. Obviously, God is, you know, many, many steps higher on that hierarchy than I am with my children, but it's still very similar. For instance, I know a whole lot more than my children do, just as God knows much more than we do. I also not just know more, but I understand things a whole lot better than my children do. And those of you who've raised kids, of course, you've been through this too, and you remember what that's like. I'm also overwhelmingly stronger than my children at this point. Eventually that'll change. That's where the analogy breaks down. But at this point, especially when they're so young, there is nothing that they can hope to do to overpower me. And I can overpower them very easily, just as God has so much more power than we do. And we cannot ever hope to challenge Him in a contest of strength. On top of all these things, as a father, I am quite naturally willing to suffer for the well-being of my children. If they're in trouble, I'm okay with getting hurt in order to protect them. I'm okay with sustaining some damage in order to keep them from being damaged. In fact, I'm okay with sustaining a lot of damage in order to keep them from sustaining a little bit of damage. Good parents are like that, naturally. They don't even have to try because they love their children. And they're willing to sacrifice. They're willing to hurt in order to bring about what's best for their kids. Now, look at it from the kids' perspective, especially as I think about my firstborn, with whom I've gone through these things before any of the others. My little boy, Titus, is a lot more emotional than I am. And that's what drives a lot of his decision-making. Similarly, in our relationship with God, we tend to, even if we know what we're supposed to do, we tend to let emotions and how we're feeling at the moment drive our decisions. Just like a child with his parent. Titus, my son, is also less self-controlled than I am. He is less patient. He struggles on a daily basis with the question of whether he is going to please Dad or please himself. These are all the same things that we go through with God, aren't they? We don't have the kind of patience that he does. We know that he has great plans. We know that he intends to bring us to heaven with him and give us a home forever. We know that he intends to save us from the world, from sinful influences, and from sin itself. And yet often we go to him and say, "When are you going to do it, Lord? I want it now." Just like the little child does. "I know Dad promised that he would feed me, but I'm hungry now." And that's what matters to him. He doesn't have that kind of patience. And he also, as I said, struggles with whether to please Dad or please himself. That's the struggle that we go through every day of our lives, isn't it? Whether we're going to please God with the choices that we make and the actions that we take, or will we please ourselves? I could go on, of course. We could probably spend the entire 50 minutes that were allotted on this. But I want to focus on one particular instance where I noticed something new in dealing with Titus. This was a situation a few years back, and it came from the newfound fear of the dark that he had developed at that time. For some reason, he just decided one day, it was almost out of the blue, that I am now afraid of the dark. And that night, suddenly, we had to start making changes. We had to leave a light on in his hallway when he was going to sleep at night. We had to put a nightlight into his room because all of a sudden, the darkness started to scare him. And it was really cute. He was, at the time, he was 2, maybe 3, and he didn't talk a whole lot. And he would just say, "I scared." And it was really adorable. You know, we found it very endearing, but it also required us to put in some effort and take some actions in order to deal with that fear. So what I want to do with you this morning is to go through this scenario, and it's one that is familiar, I'm sure, to parents and children, both even, and then compare this one scenario to our relationship with God. And as we go through, I want you to consider the themes of light and darkness. Let me give you the setting. It was late at night. My family were all at my dad's house in Illinois. We were on a trip. I think it was for Thanksgiving or something. We happened to be home for about a week. And like I said, it was late at night. We had been out. We had a long day. We'd been driving all over the countryside, going and visiting people that we don't get to see very often. And we'd come home. It's time to go to bed. My wife Harley was downstairs running on the treadmill because she's crazy. At the time, the baby was Judah. He's now the little guy who's 3 years old and looks exactly like his mom, so you'll recognize him when they come back out of class. But he was just a baby at this time. And he was asleep. And Titus was in bed in a little fold-up cot that we had in the corner of the room where we were staying. And here I was also lying in bed, winding down, getting ready to go to sleep. The room was very, very dark. Now, I've already mentioned that Titus's room at home had a nightlight, and we would leave the door to the hallway open and the light on in the hallway, so we had a little bit of light. So he's used to that. But this room was totally dark, except for the dim glow from the tablet that I was reading from or playing a game on or something as I got ready to go to sleep. As far as I knew, Titus was already asleep. And I was looking forward to going to sleep myself because we had a long day the next morning. And I heard some motion. And my hearing's not that great. I played too much loud music and did too many silly things when I was a kid. So I couldn't quite tell what it was. I heard some motion. And I assumed that what had happened was that Harley had finished running and had come upstairs and was getting ready to, you know, get showered and come to bed. So that's what I assumed. I didn't think anything of it, and I just continued to read. Turns out I was wrong. That's not what happened. Because as I sat there with the tablet in my face and the little glow shining, I noticed Titus's little face showing up in the glow right there, which was a little bit spooky in itself and took me aback. But I went from surprise to anger very quickly. I was irritated at Titus because he knows better. When once he's been put in bed for the night, he's supposed to stay there, at least at that stage. He knew that. That was the rule. We had spanked that into him. And yet here he was, breaking the rule and apparently just getting out of bed because he didn't want to be there and thought that there was something more fun going on where I was. I was exasperated because, as I mentioned, it had been a very long day, and I just didn't want to deal with it anymore. I wanted him to just do what he's supposed to do and get out of my face. Go to sleep so I don't have to worry about you. And on top of all of that, if he's up and he's moving around, he's likely to make some noise, or he's likely to jostle the bed. And if he does that, he might wake up baby Judah. And if baby Judah wakes up, then nobody's sleeping. So this was very frustrating to me. And he could see that in the expression on my face, even before I said a word. And he jumped in to say something, to defend himself. And he said, "I scared." And that pretty much disarmed me right then. Because I understood why he was afraid. Now, I also understood that his fear was unfounded. and that he didn't really have anything that was going to threaten him in this dark room. But I could understand why the darkness scared him. And it occurred to me, even in my anger at that moment, what else would I want him to do when he's afraid like that than to come to Dad? Now, I was still a little bit annoyed at him, of course. I really just wanted him to go to sleep and to be ready for the next busy day. And so I set about, as I usually do with him, trying to just explain it in terms that he can understand what he needs to do and why. I told him that I understood why he was afraid, that he's in an unknown, untried circumstance, and that he's unequipped to deal with whatever is hiding in that darkness, and that he's dependent on me to protect him. And I told him, Titus, I will protect you. I will take care of you. Even if you can't see me, I will protect you. And as I said that, right in that moment, I realized that I was experiencing the same thing that God goes through with us. Let's read Psalm 23, the first four verses. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. It's a wonderful attitude that David is displaying here in this psalm, isn't it? He uses the themes of light and darkness there, the valley of the shadow of death. And he also describes God as being a shepherd, the one that watches out for him and protects him. And even says, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Those are instruments of direction and sometimes even punishment. And yet for the sheep, they're a comfort. Because if you've got the Lord as your guide to protect you, to guide you, to show you where you need to be, when you don't know, when it's dark beyond you, and you don't understand, and you can't see the light, that's a wonderful thing to have, God's guidance throughout that, as a shepherd. Now, let's look at a contrast to that. The same themes of light and darkness. In Isaiah chapter 59, and for the, I'll mention the broader context in a second, but let's read verses 9 and 10. Therefore, justice is far from us, and righteousness does not overtake us. We hope for light, and behold, darkness. And for brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope like those who have no eyes. We stumble at noon as in the twilight. Among those in full vigor, we are like dead men. So we saw from David's perspective a situation where even if he's in the shadow of the valley of the shadow of death, he feels like there's light. And he's not going to be afraid because God's with him. Now Isaiah's relating a situation where they're terrified. They want the light, but it's not there. And if you look at the first eight verses of that chapter, you'll see why. It's because of the rampant injustice, the malice among these people, the horrible ways that they're treating each other. This darkness, what feels like blindness and what causes groping, like they're blind and even he says, among those in full vigor, we are like dead men. We can't do anything. That happened because God departed. The way that they had behaved made God get to the point where he said, I'm done. And that left them in darkness. They wished for some light so that they could see, so that they could interact with the circumstances around them properly and protect themselves and just understand their surroundings. But instead, they're stuck in darkness. They're groping for the wall like those who are blind because they don't even know where it is. That's how dark things have been left because God has departed from their presence. Turn with me also to John chapter 1. We'll do this, this one won't be up on the screen. We're going to look at a couple of passages in John. John chapter 1, let's read verses 4 and 5 together. He's introducing his gospel and he's talking about how the Word was in the beginning with God and it was God. And he says in verse 4, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." So he depicts the coming of the Son of God as a light shining in a dark place. And that darkness represents Satan and evil and the works of Satan, this world of sin and darkness. And he portrays Jesus as coming into this world, becoming a man like us, and shining light in that dark world. The kind of light that cannot be overcome by the darkness. John uses light and darkness a number of times, and we'll look at a couple later as well, but I also want to pinpoint one here in chapter 3 right now, from Jesus' own mouth. He's talking to Nicodemus. Remember, Nicodemus came to him by night, for one thing, when it was dark, because he was trying to hide his actions. We're going to come back to that theme as well. And Jesus tells him a whole lot of things, and this is one of the deepest conversations that you will ever see in the entire Bible. But he says in verses 19 through 21, "This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God." So Jesus is delivering a subtle dig here at Nicodemus for the way that he has approached Jesus. It's good that he's approaching Jesus. It's good that he's acknowledging him and trying to learn from him. But the way that he's doing it shows that he's a little bit afraid of the light. He's a little bit afraid of having his works exposed. Now, Jesus is saying that the light that has come into the world, which is Jesus himself, exposes works. And that's what decides which side we're on, whether you love the light or the darkness. And he says the world has not loved the light, it has loved the darkness, because its works were evil and they wanted them to remain hidden. And when the light shines, it exposes our works for all to see, for ourselves to see even. And we can't hide them anymore. This light, of course, is going to be rejected by some, but it will be embraced by others. And that's where we want to be, isn't it? To depart from the light-darkness dichotomy for a moment, I'd like to turn with you to Joshua chapter 1. This is going to relate the same theme, but without light and darkness being used to demonstrate it. Joshua chapter 1. Let's start by just reading verse 1. "After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant," and I realize we're at the end of a sentence, but just think about the way that he's developing the setting here. "After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord." What must that have been like for the nation of Israel, but also for Joshua, on whom the responsibility now falls? That's terrifying. Moses has been a tower of stability for 40 years for these people. He has been the guide. He has been the one to say, go here, don't go here. Do this, don't do that. When there's a dispute, he's been the final judge to say, this is what the Lord says. That happened repeatedly, over and over and over, and I can't believe that we have all of those instances recorded. But even the number that we have shows just how much Moses was a force for light among them, to show them the way, to keep them from being blind, and to expose evil works. That's what Moses has been doing, and now he's gone. Just as they're on the verge, they're just about to cross the river and go into this land that God has promised to them. That he's promised to these people specifically for 40 years and to their fathers for 500 years. This will be your land. You and your offspring will dwell here. I give it to you and your offspring. And they're so ready. They're poised to cross that river and to take over with Moses. He's been leading them in battle for such a long time. He's never led them wrong. They know that God speaks with him face to face as with a friend. And now he's gone. There's a great temptation there to just be despondent. What are we going to do now? Yeah, we've got guys like Joshua, and he's been helpful too, but he's always done what Moses said. Can we trust that he will lead us in the same way? That's a really scary situation for them to be in. But God makes a pledge. Verse 2. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness in this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. God makes this wonderful pledge to Joshua to give him confidence, and then by extension to give the people confidence, that things aren't changing as much as you think. Yes, Moses was here, and now that he's gone, that's scary. But Moses wasn't the light. Moses wasn't the one who was showing the way. He was just relaying what God said. That was all he ever claimed to do. And now God says, I will be with you, Joshua, just as I was with Moses. Don't be afraid. Be strong and courageous. I will not leave you. I will not forsake you. It's a lot like what I was telling Titus that night, isn't it? Even if it doesn't look like it right at the moment, even if you can't see me, I will protect you. I will be here. I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to forsake you. So be strong and courageous. But of course, there's a little bit more to it. Remember what we saw here in Isaiah. God has told Joshua here, I will never leave you or forsake you. But didn't we say that this is the kind of thing that happened and that brought blindness when God left them? Well, what happened? He said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Why did he leave them? Why did he forsake them? Why did he leave them in darkness? How could this be? Well, we get an explanation of this. It's not exactly what the text is intending to show, but it does show it in the next few verses. Verses 7 through 9, God adds a condition to his presence. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened, and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. There is a condition attached, of course. He's not going to stick with you no matter what, even if you're kicking against him and rejecting his word and refusing to obey his commandments. But if you will stay with him, he will stay with you. These people that Isaiah was talking about, they left God. And so he left them. But under Joshua, they stuck with him. And he stuck with them. He didn't leave them. He didn't forsake them. You might think of a couple instances. For instance, when they attacked the city of Ai and they lost, which was a bit of a bummer. They thought, how could this happen? Well, it's because someone had very pointedly rejected God's commandments. And he wasn't okay with that. Now, he didn't abandon them completely. He withdrew a little bit of his protection to let them learn a lesson. Again, just like we do with our kids sometimes. But as long as we will stick with him, he will stick with us. That's what he's telling Joshua and the children of Israel as they're preparing to enter and to conquer the promised land. And that story that we read in the book of Joshua is in many ways a shadow of Christ. He's leading them into the promised rest, for one thing. We could also throw in the name Joshua. That's the Hebrew version, well, it's the anglicized Hebrew version of what becomes Jesus later on. Joshua and Jesus are the same name. He's a shadow in that way as well. The way that they go in and they conquer all of these evil nations, that's a shadow of Christ. He came to the world and he conquered the works of darkness and the forces of darkness, casting out demons and eventually crushing Satan beneath his foot, especially shown when he rose from the dead and said, well, death has no power over me. He conquered, just like Joshua did. Joshua shows us a lot of shadows of Christ, and I think that's probably why the author of Hebrews in chapter 13 quotes this very passage. He's summing things up at the end of this letter, and he says, keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? That's the same thing, isn't it? The author of Hebrews is applying what God told Joshua to us. He has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. The Lord's my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? God's presence has been promised to us. And the way that that is expressed so many times, as we've looked at briefly already, is through light and darkness. It's a very, very common theme throughout the Bible, either explicitly or implicitly describing God and his followers, the struggle of that they have against Satan and his followers. Think about creation. What's the first thing God made? Day one. We sing a little song that we teach the kids. Day one, God made light when there was none. That's the first thing. He makes light. It's interesting. He doesn't make the sun first. He makes light first. So instead of making the physical instrument that we can see providing light, we know that's where our light comes from. But he actually created light before that. Isn't that surprising? And interesting and maybe instructive. Think about the tabernacle, the pattern that he designed, that he told Moses on the mountain. He said, I want you to build it in exactly this way. And he gave all these very detailed instructions. One of those details was that it should face east. Okay, big deal. Who cares? It should face the rising of the sun. So that when the sun rises every morning, it shines directly on the front of the sanctuary. The same thing happened with the temple later on. God didn't specifically command it in that instance, but they followed the precedent. The temple faced east. It's the same reason. To face the dawn. To face the rising light. Thinking about Joshua. One of the battles that Joshua and the children of Israel engaged in. He prayed to God and the sun stood still. And gave them light. So that they could conquer the enemies of God and his people. God gave him that light so that they could do so. There are many symbolic uses of light in the law of Moses. One of the best examples is, you can find it in Leviticus 24 if you want to read about it. The priests were to keep a lamp burning all night, every night, as a symbol. That God has not departed. That there is still light here. That God is with us. It's a symbol of his unfailing presence. We see it in the Psalms. We've already read in Psalm 24, the middle two verses or so. Even if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. It's the same thing there. He doesn't explicitly use the term light, but it uses darkness and says God gets us through the darkness. There's another one, just three after that, Psalm 27, that begins, "The Lord is my light." Several other places in the Psalms where he's described that way. There are lots of uses in the prophets. We read one in Isaiah 59 just a few minutes ago. That theme continues into the New Testament. For instance, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3. He, that's Jesus, is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. The radiance? He's talking about light. The radiance of the glory of God. He's talking about the light that shines, for example, think about Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. You remember what happens there? He's shiny. He's light. That's what James and John and Peter all saw. They had to look away. It was so bright. Same thing happened with Moses, by the way. Remember when he spoke to God on the mountain and he came down? And it was as if the glory of God was reflecting from his face, and they couldn't look at him. They were terrified. And he had to cover it up with a veil. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God. In John's Gospel, we already looked at one of these in chapter 1 and another in chapter 3. Let's look at three more where Jesus says things like this. Again, Jesus spoke to them saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." In chapter 9, verse 5, he says, "As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Chapter 12, verse 46, he says, "I have come into the world as light, that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness." Now, these are all deep. We could spend an entire lesson just talking about each one of these verses and everything that's behind those. He's the light. We've talked about how it exposes the darkness, how it brings comfort. "Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Moving on into the letters, Peter uses this. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. He's talking about the Mount of Transfiguration, and he says, he spoke about that just before, and then he says, "And we have the prophetic word more fully confirmed, to which you will do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in a dark place, until the day dawns, and the morning star rises in your hearts." A couple of extra things that aren't perhaps terribly obvious. The lamp shining in a dark place, he's not the first to say that. Psalm 119, "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." That's what God's word is. The prophetic word of God does that, and it shows us the way. It shows us where to put our feet. And then he says, "Until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." And what is he talking about there? Well, he's just described Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration and what he and those other two witnessed there. He's talking about Jesus. He's talking about when Jesus returns. The day dawns when the light comes back to the world in a more obvious way. When the morning star, by the way, the Greek word behind that is phosphorus, which is light bringer. The morning star rises in your hearts when Jesus, who brings the light, comes back. When that rises in your hearts and the day dawns. Once again, Jesus is the light. We can see it also throughout 1 John. We won't go there right now. But read 1 John and just look at light and darkness, those two themes. It shows the effects that the light will have on us. It shows how it cleanses us from sin and shows us the way to love our brothers and requires that we love our brothers, among other things. Another example, turn with me to 1 Thessalonians 5. We'll have a little bit of a longer reading here. 1 Thessalonians 5, let's read the first 11 verses of the chapter. Talking about something very similar to what Peter was mentioning up here. "Now concerning the times and the seasons, brothers, you have no need to have anything written to you, for you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night." So we've got the day of the Lord, and we've got the thief in the night. We've got light and darkness again. "While people are saying there is peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them, as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. But you are not in darkness, brothers, for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light, children of the day. We are not of the night or of the darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet the hope of salvation. For God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we might live with Him. Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing. Again, there's so much there. We could easily spend the whole lesson just on those 11 verses. The day of the Lord comes like a thief in the night, when everybody is in darkness. And they might say peace and security, but they're in darkness. And they're going to be surprised. They're not going to know when it's going to come. And suddenly the light will shine and it will expose what they're doing. It will expose the things like he uses those who sleep, sleep at night. Those who get drunk are drunk at night. He's using sleep as a metaphor here for those who are living in the darkness, who are living sinful lives. The light exposes those works. We see it in Romans. Romans chapter 13, let's read verses 12 and 13. Paul says, "The night is far gone, the day is at hand. So then let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the daytime." Again, this gives us a very clear picture of how we ought to behave in the light and not in the darkness. Light is a fearful thing when you want to be hidden. But if you're with God, then darkness may be fearful, but it should not make us despair. God has promised to stick with us. He won't leave you. He won't forsake you. He wants to shine His light on you. He wants you to live in the light, to feel safe and secure and not afraid, to not be uncertain about where you're going to put your next step, but to see it clearly. Does that mean that He's going to fight our battles for us? That He is going to destroy all of our enemies and give us all the land that we can tread, like with Joshua? It's probably not exactly that same thing, is it? In fact, it's much more important. Let's go back to the beginning where I was talking about my relationship with my children, and particularly with my oldest, Titus. Another manifestation of his fear of the dark when he developed that, and another instance in which he displayed it in a very cute manner, was that occasionally we would have to go down a staircase or something into a dark room, and we'd be going into my basement or something, and the lights are off down there. And he'd want to come with me, and I'd say, "Sure, you can come with me." And we'd start to walk down, and he would notice, "Oh, it's dark down there." And he would say, like he would say in all these other instances, "I'm scared." But what really endeared him to me in those instances was that he started saying, "I'm scared." And then he'd put up his hand to grab mine without even looking at me. He put up his hand because he knew that I was going to reach out and take it. He knew that I wasn't going to leave him or forsake him. That I wasn't going to make him go into that dark, fearful place on his own. He trusted me. And he knew that I would be there, and that was as good as having a light. And he didn't have to be afraid of what monsters might lurk in the darkness. He didn't have to be afraid of where he was going to put his foot next. He didn't have to be afraid that he was going to run into something, because Dad was there and would not leave him or forsake him. That's the attitude that we need to take. We need to be able to admit our fear and to recognize fearful situations, to recognize when we're going into darkness. But we also need to be ready and willing to reach out and grab God's hand, to trust that He will protect us, that He will guide us, that He will show us the way. Grab His hand and then keep going. Now, of course, this isn't license to just put yourself into dangerous situations without any reason. That is not any good for anybody. We ought to exercise our judgment. And so, for instance, let's say if you're an alcoholic, then going into the bar might be considered stepping into a dark place. And it would not be a good idea to say, oh, well, God is with me and He's promised not to leave and forsake me. Therefore, I can go right in here and He's going to take care of me. Now, He's willing to do that, but you're deliberately stepping into a very dangerous situation. And the light that He has shown should have shown you by now that that's a bad idea and you shouldn't do it. He's not going to follow you into darkness. He's going to abolish the darkness if you'll let Him. We need to exercise our judgment. Remember Isaiah 59. What those people had done, their injustice toward each other, their malignant attitudes, the ways that they had oppressed each other, there was no light shining there. They were not letting God's light show them the way. They were living in darkness already, and so God was saying, okay, well, let's just make it a thing then. I'm going to back off. I'm not going to give you any light anymore. And you can grope around in the darkness and see how you like that. He'll do that for us too. That's what Paul says in Romans 1. He gives people up to their corrupt works when they refuse to recognize what He has shown them. So exercise your judgment. But when you need, for whatever reason, to walk through the valley of the shadow of death, don't rely on yourself to grope along and find the wall like you're blind. Rely on God. Holding His hand in the situation means more than just, you know, sort of being in contact with Him. If Titus were going into a situation like that and said, I'm scared, and reached out for my hand and then grabbed it and then just started kicking me or trying to drag me into a place where I didn't want him to go, let alone myself, that wouldn't have endeared him to me nearly as much, and I would not have found that to be an acceptable behavior. Don't do that to God. Don't say, I'm holding your hand, but then kick him. Don't say, I'm holding your hand, and then tug in a direction that he has told you he doesn't want you to go. Holding his hand means going where he directs. It means doing what he instructs. It means observing the path that he has lit in front of you and using that one. His word is that lamp, and it shows you the way, and that lamp is not going anywhere. It's always there for you. Holding his hand means staying near him and near his word and not being afraid of having his light expose your deeds. Not being afraid of his scrutiny because you're not doing shameful works of darkness. It means trust and love and obedience. Throughout our lives, in every situation, in every danger, whether it's something physical or, more importantly, if it's something spiritual, let's do our best to act like an innocent, trusting child who's afraid of something, whether it's a known or an unknown, but trusts his ever-present Father and can calmly state, I'm scared. And then reach out for his Father's hand, which he knows will always be there. The hand of one that he knows will take care of him and keep him safe and give him comfort and guide him through the dangers, never leaving or forsaking him. I encourage you to reach out for God's hand and trust him to protect you, to enlighten your path, even if you can't see him at the moment. Let's close by reading a few verses from Psalm 139. Psalm 139, let's read verses 7 through 12. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you.